So I read recently that the Subaru Ascent has 19 cup holders. 19. The article I read said these cup holders fit everything from a skinny latte to a big gulp, and there's many, many spots for juice boxes. It seems like, well, the children need to drink too, so maybe that's why, but still, 19? Another article I read, a review, suggested that maybe other manufacturers simply don't understand the human need for hydration. But it still makes us wonder. 19 cup holders. That's almost 3 per person. If the Samaritan woman had driven a Subaru, she would never be thirsty again. Now, the Samaritan woman is one of the people that Jesus meets in the Gospel of John, and this sermon is kind of a set of a series where I'm looking at some of the encounters Jesus has with different people in John's Gospel. And one of the interesting things about these is that John kind of narrows things down, so he records less miracles maybe than the other Gospels do, less encounters or conversations with people, but he also extends them, so these conversations are longer and deeper and richer than in other places. And so we feel like we get to know these people as they come to see Jesus. And that's kind of another feature of John, that people come to see Jesus. Seeing is very important. And so on Easter, you can look at that story and you hear that well, Mary Magdalene went to the those who were in the upper room and said, "We've seen the Lord." That those in the upper room said to Thomas, "We have seen the Lord." But Thomas says, "Unless I see the nail hands, I will not believe." Jesus responds later to Thomas and says, "Well, blessed are you, but blessed are those who do not see and yet believe." And then if you kind of spool back to the first encounter, you notice that the disciple Jesus loved simply looked into the tomb and saw and believed. And so then kind of starting from there, I kind of look back through the rest of the gospel and notice that there are other people who come to see Jesus. Nicodemus, for example, came to see Jesus at night. This woman came to see Jesus as a prophet. There is a man at a pool who Jesus speaks to. There's a man who was born blind who comes to see, that seeing is important. And in each of those, you can see also that as on Easter, the beloved disciple, Mary, the ones in the upper room, Thomas, each came to see and believe, but in a different fashion. At the beginning of the gospel, think people like Nicodemus and the woman and the man at the pool and the blind man all encounter Jesus in a slightly different way. Am I walking too much?
No, there's something wrong.
Okay. I'll try. So various people come to see Jesus, and each one in their own particular way. And we feel like we get to know these people because these conversations are longer. We feel, for example, like we get to know this woman whom Jesus met at the well. And one of the things we can notice from that as John presents these different accounts, that, for example, some of them come in pairs. And if you think about this woman and Nicodemus, well, they almost seem like mirror images of each other. That in very many ways, this woman and Nicodemus are the opposite of each other. Now, I don't know if you've ever had pastors ask questions of members of the congregation, what ways are this woman different from Nicodemus? Does anyone want to hazard a guess? Am I pushing you farther than your comfort zone? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Nicodemus is one, as a Pharisee, is someone who's seeking to serve the Lord in everything. And the woman has a somewhat different character. I feel like too loud now. Anyone else? I mean, on the simplest level, he's a man. She's a woman.
He's a Jew.
She's a Samaritan.
And as she herself points out, you know, Jews have nothing to do with Samaritans. He's named Nicodemus. This woman is one of the unnamed characters in this gospel.
And it's interesting sometimes that the unnamed characters, you wonder whether that gives us as readers the opportunity to identify better with someone who doesn't have a name than, like, the beloved disciple, than someone who does. He's a leader. Nicodemus is described as a leader among the Jews. Her status is simply not known. He comes to Jesus at night. And it's not really clear through the story whether Nicodemus, when he leaves, Nicodemus might still be in the dark. Darkness and light are another theme in the Gospel of John. But this woman comes to Jesus, or speaks to Jesus, under the full harsh light of noon when it's kind of unexpected, because normally women would have come in the cool of the day. And so that also gives us a hint maybe about something about her past. But Nicodemus came to see Jesus in secret, at night, under the cover of darkness. This woman's conversation with Jesus is out in the open. Nicodemus was in the city. This woman was out in the countryside. Nicodemus came to Jesus with his question. Well, we know that you are a teacher sent from God, because no one could do the miraculous signs that you do unless God was with him, Nicodemus said. Nicodemus initiated that conversation. But Jesus initiates the conversation with this woman. Nicodemus, as a Pharisee, was clean, you would assume. But was this woman? And so in many ways, she seems to be the exact opposite of Nicodemus. They seem to be polar opposites, mirror images of each other, maybe suggesting for us that the range of people who come to Jesus, the range of Jesus, the people that Jesus is speaking to. And yet, both are speaking to Jesus. And both are looking for something. Nicodemus sought Jesus out because, as a Pharisee, as a student of the law at the night, maybe at a time when Pharisees or students of the law would study Torah, study the law, he came looking for answers to his questions. He came for understanding. But this woman, she came to a well because she was thirsty. And it was a good well. It was a deep well. It was a well that had been given to them by their ancestor, Jacob. Jacob had given it to his descendants, and their tradition was that they had received it then as a gift from Jacob. It was a well that had been supplying water for a long, long time. It was deep, and its waters flowed. Now, the Bible has two different words for well. And the one that's used here in the Greek language is pege. Pege. And it describes it could also be translated as a fountain or a spring, because the waters of a pege, they bubble, they flow, they spring up like in a well, they overflow like in a fountain. They are waters that are moving, and so unlike the stale or dead waters in a cistern, this water was alive, it was moving, and the woman came to this well because she was thirsty. And we all are. We all are. A woman came to see me once shortly after I'd started off in a new congregation. She had a message for me. She said that God had told her that God had some great things in mind for our congregation, that God had some great things in mind for our church, and that God would use me to accomplish those things if I would allow God to do that. God had told her that. And I have to admit, it was flattering. It's flattering because she had visions of God leading the church and visions of me leading the church to someplace important, and that kind of appealed to my sense of grandeur and my thirst to be important or significant or make a mark in the world. But there was also something kind of unsettling about that conversation. I couldn't quite put my finger on it at the time. But I came to see that there was really no end to her thirst. And she too was thirsty. She was thirsty for something more, to be a part of something significant, to be recognized. She was thirsty. But then we all are.
I can remember leading a group of high school students in a week's vacation Bible school in a little church in northeastern Nebraska on a reserve there. And the Reformed Church pastor, he kind of observed some of the kids and the way they were interacting with the children who'd come to vacation Bible school, and he commented about how sometimes people coming wanting to help could do a great deal of harm because they didn't recognize their own emptiness and they were trying to fill a hole in themselves. They saw the needs of others. They didn't see their own needs and ended up in situations where they were trying to satisfy their own thirst by helping others but ended up hurting others instead. They were thirsty. Now, when Jesus pointed out said that if the woman had asked him, he would have given her living water, she pointed out that, well, Jesus didn't have a bucket to draw from. But the word used, that's the word used in the translation I was using. The translation we read simply said, you don't have anything to draw water with. And the word that's used there in the Greek language is anthlema. It's related to the word draw, antleo water out with an anthlema, a bucket. It's probably a minor textual point. But maybe it can remind us, or we can allow it to remind us, that because we're thirsty, we keep going back to the well with the buckets that we have. I knew a man who was preparing to be a pastor. He was older than I was at the time. He was in probably, you know, maybe similar to the age I am now. But he'd sold his dairy cows, he'd taken a few courses, he'd gotten a license to preach from classes, he was looking for a church, he was wanting to be a pastor, and I overheard him talking to someone once about why he'd made that transition in his life, why he was looking for something new, and I heard him say something like that he'd been successful in his business and successful as a farmer, and he'd achieved what he'd wanted to, and now he was looking to do something different. It's a fairly common story. You know, people achieve a certain degree of success in their jobs and they find that they're still thirsty. People get to a certain point in life and they realize that they haven't reached the aims they have, that things have not been quite as satisfying as they'd hoped. And sometimes they have reached their goals and they're still not quite satisfied as they'd hoped. And usually when we hear a story like that, we hear that people, you know, they change jobs, they move to another part of the country, they switch to the nonprofit sector. Some try to reinvest in long neglected relationships, only to discover that their children have moved on and aren't really interested in hanging out with daddy anymore. That sometimes they invest in new relationships. They try to find something more satisfaction by a change, only to find that they're still thirsty. It's a fairly common story. The guy in the dairy farmer becoming a pastor kind of made me wonder, though. Because if ministry is what people turn to when they've reached their goals in other parts of life, and you do hear, see, in a lot of denominations, a lot of second career pastors. But if that's people's second career, well, where does that leave those of us who started out in ministry? What do? There was a time I was part of a leadership development network with the Christian Reformed Church, and I learned a lot of good things there. After a while, some of us in that course began to notice, though, that the examples that we were given of people who had kind of reached peak leadership potential were all people who'd left ministry in local congregations to go serve in a denominational office or a parachurch organization or something like that. And, well, not only weren't there that many positions in those places, but we wondered where that left the church. It's a fairly common story. We keep coming back to the well with our buckets empty. We're thirsty. Now, I mentioned the word for well earlier, one of the two Greek words for well, partly because, well, it gave me a way to structure this service using the names of different water vessels that we find it in this passage. But also because that word for well changes partway through the story. We're told that Jesus came to Jacob's well, to his pege, that he sat by that well, that pege, that he said that the water that he gives would become a pege, a fountain, a spring, a well of living water welling up, springing up to eternal life. So that word gets repeated. But just before Jesus says that the water he gives would become a well, a pege, springing up to eternal life, the woman used another word and called the well they were at a phrear. Now, in contrast to a pege, which is water is bubbling and springing up and flowing and moving, the waters in a phrear do not move. It's more like a cistern than a spring. More like a vat than a fountain. And so in contrast to the waters of a fountain or a spring, the waters of a phrear are somewhat stale. And the word shifts partway through the story. Now that could be just because authors like to vary their vocabulary from time to time to keep from being boring, but I think it's more likely here that in this case, the shift in vocabulary from pege to phrear suggests that for this woman, that good waters, the waters of Jacob's well, are stale. There's no life there. That the well she keeps coming back to again and again is more like a cistern than a well. And it cannot give her the life that she's thirsty for. We were sitting at the stands at an arena watching our sons play hockey. She'd been coming to the church that I was serving there for a while, and I'd known her from that. I'd also known her from school and from hockey, a couple of different things, but I'd never really sat down and talked to her for a while. And I'm not sure how the conversation took the turn that it did, because it's not really the kind of conversation you'd expect to end up having in the stands of a hockey arena while your kids are playing peewee hockey. But she told me she never really expected to be in the position that she found herself there. That she'd imagined a much different life for herself than the life that she'd ended up with. That in high school, in youth group, she'd been the good girl, the one that everyone expected to turn out well, that everyone expected that she would be the one who would end up in a long and stable marriage, and yet here I am, she says, married 5 times. And I honestly didn't know what to say. I mean, I knew a little bit about her story, but 5 times? I didn't know how that was possible for someone her age. I didn't know how it was possible for anyone. I later wondered, actually, whether she was intentionally comparing herself to this woman at the well. And it's possible. Or maybe I was still trying to just avoid the implications of what she told me. But why would anyone compare herself to this Samaritan woman? I left the story till here because, well, I wonder whether the detail is actually meant to surprise us. That we're not supposed to see this coming the way, really, I didn't see that woman's story coming. See, John doesn't begin the story by telling us that Jesus was, you know, leaving the region and going up to Samaria because, well, the Jews had found out that he was doing more baptisms than John the Baptist, though it wasn't Jesus baptizing, but John the Baptist who was baptizing. And so he's kind of getting away for a little while, and he comes through this area, and he's tired, and he sits down at the well. The disciples go into town to buy food, and then a woman who's been married 5 times comes to the well. John doesn't tell us that. John leaves this tidbit till now. Perhaps because by leaving it till later, he surprises us a little bit. It makes us kind of take another look at the story. And so I left it here because I'm wondering whether this detail is meant to surprise us, and I wonder whether it gets lost because, well, we think we know her. And let's check on that. I mean, how many of us think that she's questionable, that her character was questionable? How many of us aren't sure simply because I'm asking the question? See, one preacher says that there are any number of reasons to think that, imagine her story as tragic rather than scandalous. Now, we can think of any number of reasons to think her story as tragic. She may have been widowed 5 times, and that was hard to imagine, but that would be a tragedy. Her current status could possibly be similar to the status of that one daughter-in-law of Judah who was married to the oldest son only to see him die, married to the next son only to see him die, you know, bound in this Levirate marriage arrangement where she couldn't marry anyone else because the next son's job was to take over his older brother's responsibilities, but he didn't want to do that because he was afraid he would die too. And that would be tragic. There's a possibility of concubinage or slavery where she really hasn't got a whole lot of say over what happens in her life. There's lots of reasons this preacher suggests to think of her story as tragic rather than scandalous, but most preachers like me will try to make it out as scandalous as possible, as if the brighter shade of red we can paint her fingernails, the more dramatic this story is. Maybe that's just because that's the way we've heard the story all the time. This detail about the number of husbands she's had doesn't come as a surprise with us. Maybe that we think we know her and we can't see anything else. Maybe it's partly because in our tradition, you know, we believe that a knowledge of sin comes before a knowledge of salvation and then the desire to be grateful. And so Jesus must be trying to poke away and get her to confess her sin here. Maybe assuming that she's scandalous allows us to be sure that our bucket is not as leaky as her bucket was. For all the holes our bucket has, it was not at least as leaky as hers. But you know, it really doesn't matter how leaky a bucket is if we're still drawing from a cistern. See, we're thirsty. We're thirsty. And sometimes I think we think the woman was changing the subject when she asked Jesus about worship. When Jesus says, yeah, what you've said is true. Which is, by the way, one of the reasons to think, well, maybe there's more going on here, because Jesus doesn't say those kinds of words lightly. What you say is true. She comes then to say, you are a prophet. And then seeing that Jesus was a prophet, she asks the vital question that Samaritans had: which mountain do we worship on? And so her question actually touches on another way that we seek to satisfy our thirst. I had lunch recently with a number of other pastors, and in that conversation, the conversation drifted towards worship and worship modes. Most of it was pretty good-natured ribbing of each other's traditions. I mean, but kind of like, do we worship by a book of prayer, or with a fog machine? One of the guys mentioned that it was really hard to get his congregation to lift their heads up out of the book, that they would have to actually try things to get them, you know, beyond just the written page. But he says, my people, they love to read. He was Newfoundlander. That has nothing to do with it. Just an interesting accent that I can't really mimic. Another mentioned how people end up in worship really designed to be participatory, but they end up just kind of watching the show that's going up beyond the fog machines at the front. And someone else commented on how some of these really so-called cutting-edge churches are going back and writing really traditional liturgies at times.
And that variety and that flow and that movement from one thing to another and that constant seeking for some new thing or that constant clinging to some old thing reminds us that even worship can be a phreyar, a cistern that fails to hold living water. It's a symptom of our thirst. A thirst that we're not satisfying. Now there's one more water vessel in this story. We've seen that the well was first called a pege, a fountain. The woman then asked Jesus, well, where's your antlema, your bucket? Even while describing the well as a phreyar, a cistern. And at the very end of the story, we're told that the woman left her hudrian, her water jar, and she went off to the city. Now, it could be an insignificant detail. It's just kind of there. I mean, it just mentioned that just a bit of local color, but maybe we shouldn't read into it too much. But the fact that in this story where the well is described as a pege, then a freya, that there's a bucket mentioned, and lema, the fact that she leaves her water jar suggests, hints, that she doesn't need it anymore. She doesn't need it anymore. Because in this encounter with Jesus, she's come to see that Jesus is a prophet. That when Jesus starts talking about worshiping in spirit and truth, she says, well, the Messiah, he will answer those questions when he comes. And then Jesus says, well, I am the one who is talking to you. It's him. It's me. And she saw Jesus and didn't need her water jar anymore. And when Jesus showed that he knew her, she saw Jesus was a prophet. When Jesus asked about the prophet, Jesus told her about the gift of living water, the water of the Spirit who would animate those who worship the Father, and she didn't need her water jar anymore. And when Jesus said that he was the Messiah, the one speaking to her, left that water jug, she tasted then the living water. And she went back to her village and she told the people there, come see a man who told me everything I ever did. And she herself became a fountain. Let us pray. Gracious God, we thank you for the living water that you give us in Jesus Christ. We thank you for the promise that those who are born of water and the Spirit will see the kingdom of heaven. We pray that your Spirit would be for us life-giving water that allows us to see Jesus so that we may live in his name.